All right, this is the biggie. We want to know, how do you test for leaky gut? How do you know if you have this? Is this the end-all be-all of functional medicine diagnostics? Amy, what do you think? Like, just off the cuff in the beginning of the episode, is this the be-all end-all of functional medicine diagnostics?
No.
episode done. Bye, people.
I know. We can save you a lot of time. You know, I think in my experience, you know, there could be a time and place for leaky gut testing. I haven't really done much of it in my clinical practice outside of like maybe what I used to do, GI maps. There were like some markers on there, which again have their issues. I'm sure we'll go into some of those. So again, like I've dabbled in some leaky gut types of biomarkers and things like that. But I think from my standpoint, when it comes to permeability, a lot of it is about really understanding what's driving the permeability. And we know a lot of different strategies that are going to help make your gut less permeable and stronger and strengthen the gut barrier. So from my standpoint, much of the energy should be focused on that. And there's definitely people that I work with that I don't really think have permeability. And then there's other people that might, and that I think really do. And even the people that I'm fairly confident have permeability, if they do the baseline fundamental strategies, they usually improve a lot and they don't need to do any testing.
And that's the thing is, like, if you do all the other stuff that we teach you here on this podcast and on our independent channels and on our work, you will treat leaky gut. Whether or not you're treating the leaky gut intentionally is up for grabs. But I straight up torture my students. I think I've told you this, right? So in FODMAP Freedom, I make the students wait to get to the topic of leaky gut. I think it's like week 8. Out of 12 is when we talk about leaky gut. And some people get really twitchy and antsy and they ask about it, they complain, and they ask if they can get that module early. And the same thing with the antimicrobial conversation later on. But I keep telling students, trust the process, have faith in the process. By the time you get to the leaky gut module, you will see that you've been treating leaky gut all along. It's just that I wasn't teaching it through that lens for the first 7 modules. But by the time you get to module 8, you'll see.
Right. Right. 100%. Yeah, it's, you know, when it comes to building that gut barrier, the body, for the most part, knows how to do it. It just needs the right resources and the right environment to be able to build the gut lining and maintain the gut lining. And so, you know, I think you could potentially test for it, or you could just do all the things that we say, and it'll just naturally improve.
Well, and I'll throw this out there too. And this rings close to home because I think I mentioned this in the last episode about leaky gut. This was my big thing, I thought. So when I had IBSD and I was struggling with my symptoms in like the 2010, 2013 kind of range, I was convinced I had leaky gut. I just thought I had a really severe case of leaky gut, and that's why it was being stubborn and I couldn't treat it. And I was cutting out quote unquote inflammatory foods, and I was doing leaky gut healer uppers. There's one called RepairVite. Have I ever told you what I think personally RepairVite tastes like as a side note?
I think I've taken it before. It's like an Apex. It's an Apex
product.
Right?
And I don't mind saying this publicly in a podcast because I have told Apex employees this for many years and nobody listens to me. I always likened the taste of RepairVite to cardboard and wet feet.
Oh, God.
It is not a good flavor profile. It's like dirt. So anyway, I lived off that stuff for like 3+ years. And I would feel a bit better taking the leaky gut healer upper. And then I would get off of it and I would relapse. And I kept going back and forth. And again, I thought that I had the world's most stubborn case of leaky gut because that was the dominant sexy trend and the dominant sexy diagnosis.
Right.
At all of the seminars and all of the conference, that's the only thing they talked about was leaky gut, practically. So I kind of sip the Kool-Aid, much like I think happens with SIBO nowadays. People get swept up in the SIBO trend, and they become convinced that it must be SIBO. And we know there's issues with testing for SIBO, but I'm trying to circle back to the point because I had an original point and now I've totally lost it in my excitement here. I think that my point is, twofold. Healing leaky gut should be the shortest part of your treatment program, in my opinion, because you turn over a new crop of epithelial cells every 3 or 4 days.
Right.
So if you find that you have to treat leaky gut for like weeks and months and years at a time, you know that your biggest problem is not leaky gut. First of all, you're clearly not getting to the root because it keeps coming back. So there's a cause that keeps causing the thing. But also, theoretically, you should just be able to slap together a whole bunch of glutamine, chug it for 3-4 days, and then you're golden. If you have the nutrition and the support and the physiology that supports good gut health in the first place. And that's really the wild card in all of this. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I think one other consideration, if you're trying to determine like, do I do a leaky gut test? I feel like it's present and I'm having some like systemic symptoms that kind of make me think like it could be a leaky gut thing. And, you know, I just am convinced that I have permeability. And then you might even realize like, I have dysbiosis, like I have things that more promote leaky gut. If you're going to spend, I'm trying to think of what like a leaky gut test cost. I can't remember.
Probably like around 250.
Yeah, I was going to say around 200. So somewhere like 200, 250. Like, let's just say you haven't figured out how you're going to work all the fundamental stuff in right here, right now. Like, there could be a scenario where you kind of understand your root causes, understand that leaky gut's potentially a factor for you. Do you spend that $250 on the test? Or do you maybe do like some supplemental things that might help through the time being of while you're working on the other things? There could be an argument to say that that might be a better option. And that's kind of the things that you weigh during your strategies in general.
Well, you should.
You should weigh these things in. Like, having a definitive answer, is what a test will give you potentially. But again, none of the tests are perfect. So, you know, there's this illusion too that's kind of funny when we talk about functional medicine, because people will get, you know, a SIBO test or something and they'll be like, but you still have SIBO. This was negative. And it's like, well, why did I test? There's situations like that with leaky gut testing too, where it's like, this marker wasn't positive, but you could still have permeability and leaky gut and might as well treat it anyway. So I think from my standpoint too, even if right here, right now, maybe it's a stressful time where you just can't bite off all the lifestyle factors, or like you work night shift or something and that's really stressing your body out. It's going to take some time to where you can find a job where you can get your circadian rhythms back in line. Like, situations like that where it's just not the time and place where you can really get all your ducks in a row, doing some leaky gut support to try to reduce symptoms might be a good strategy. Might be the better strategy than getting a definitive test if, like, you're weighing pros and cons of how to spend your money.
Yeah, and keep in mind, too, that oftentimes practitioners, at least, are going to recommend that you retest, sometimes numerous times.
Yeah.
So you take that $250 price tag and you potentially multiply it a few times. And then again, the cost really does add up. What I will pose is this. A couple of thoughts is that clinically, what should be happening if your clinical team is good, but I will say this doesn't always happen, you and your team should always be weighing the pros and cons of something like testing. Yes, there's a cost factor, there's an accuracy factor, but there's a really important question clinically that we need to ask, which is, will the result of this test change the treatment plan?
Right.
If the answer is no, then I don't know if I see the point, right? Like if you're going to recommend, or like if I'm going to recommend that the person eats a wide variety of plant foods and gets enough fiber and eats foods with polyphenols and maybe takes some probiotics and maybe works on their gut-brain axis and takes some HCL, if that's going to be the recommendation, regardless of the leaky gut test, and it's just a matter of like, do we add glutamine or do we not?
Right. Well,
why don't you just treat empirically, try out the glutamine and see if it makes you feel better? And then, boom, there's your test right there. But I find that that question of like, will this test actually inform clinical decision making and change the treatment plan? Like, that's not always getting asked, either outwardly or inwardly. So that's one consideration in all of this.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I think providers too sometimes just have assumptions and like plans in their head.
Well, anyway, and protocols and templates.
Right, protocols. They're right? templates.
Here and are like the five functional tests I run on literally everybody, regardless right. of scenario. End of story. And I'm sorry, like that's, I'm not going to pay the big bucks to work with a clinician who thinks that way. Like it's not rocket science to just slap together a protocol and do it on every single human being. Similarly, right. it's not rocket science to recommend the same damn diet to every single human being. Like, I want more nuance than that.
Right, for sure. No, I agree. I think that that's a really worthy question and something to consider when you're working with providers.
Yeah. Now, here's the question, my dear. So we already brought up this idea of you probably don't need to test. At the bare minimum, the people listening to this podcast have way bigger fish to fry, and they need to work on those things first before they even think about wasting money on testing or spending money on testing. And we talked about the idea of just treating empirically. That means treating without test results and just seeing what happens. So, you know, it does it make more sense to spend $200 or $300 on a leaky gut test? Or does it make more sense to buy a $30 or $40 canister of L-glutamine, try it out and see what happens? So those things aside, you know damn well that there are going to be people listening right now and they're like, yeah, but...
Right.
It's that OCD brain, right? Yeah, but what if, yeah. but what if? So for the people who maybe have a touch more OCD and they want that illusion of certainty and that illusion of a definitive answer, what might we tell them? And I have two things in mind personally with this part. Do we want to lead with what we would actually recommend for, and I'm using air quotes, leaky gut testing? Or do we want to lead with the commercially available tests and why those may or may not make a lot of sense? I'm kind of leaning toward the latter.
Yeah, for sure. For okay. sure. We can do that.
So like you want to throw one out there and we can noodle on it?
Yeah, I feel like the one, the one that's really popular, I feel like is because of the GI map, is the zonulin marker, mm-hmm. Which again, zonulin's a protein in the gut, and it is involved in permeability. It usually will increase if there's more permeability.
Yep.
But there's definitely a lot of problems using that marker. I know it has a shorter half-life and things. So sometimes there's a lot of false negatives.
You can measure this in stool, so like a GI map, for example, right. or you can measure it in blood, potentially. Yeah. So yes. there's two options for the same molecule for zonulin. I think that this was really popularized by Dr. Fasano's stuff in like the, 2010, 2011 kind of range. And it's become this darling ever since.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I think I cut you off. Did you have more?
No, you're totally fine. Keep going.
I'm sorry. If you people aren't used to us by this point, 172 episodes
I just let
in,
you roll.
I don't know what to tell you.
I like you roll.
Hold on. Hold the phone. Is that a dog... pillow
oh, I've
that
never
you just
showed
snuck
you
behind
this
your
before.
Back.
It's Chip as a baby.
That is the most perfect pillow I ever.
And the
did
other
see.
Side has me and Armand with Chip.
Oh, that's even cuter. Look at you. Oh my gosh, I just had to call that out. So the people on YouTube get to see that. All of you audio only people are suckers. You don't get to see.
Yeah, you.
just save this.
I was
going to
say
go
you
look at the
suck,
video.
But I feel like that was that not.
That's
good,
harsh, Amy.
That is
too harsh.
I'm sorry.
Anyhow.
I knew that's why I didn't say it, but then I actually did say it. So
luckily, you people know that we're jokesters. We love you all. Anyhow, getting back to zonulin. I've had my suspicions about zonulin for a while, and you're right, it does seem to have a short half-life, which is part of the problem. What's really interesting, though, and I have to give credit where credit is due here. So Dr. Ruscio had a guest video. I don't know if it was a podcast per se, but he had a guest video on his YouTube channel. Hold on, let me look back. I think it was posted on January 22nd, because that's the date that I wrote down. I don't think that's the day I viewed it. But he interviewed a guy from Mayo Clinic who is studying and researching and developing leaky gut testing. And one of the biggest points that I thought was important from that video was that this guy said the tests, at least the blood tests that are claiming to measure zonulin, are not. They are measuring zonulin family proteins, not zonulin itself. So that's a whole other layer. Now, whether or not this is true of a stool zonulin test like GIMAP, I don't know. But that's good to know, right? Like, you think that you're getting a test for one thing and you're potentially testing something a bit different. Right. It kind of reminds me, do you remember this? Like, back in the day on the GIMAP, they used to claim that they were measuring, I should have thought about it. What is the bacteria, the Prevotella species? Copri, I think. Prevotella copri. They claimed to measure Prevotella copri on the GI map for quite a few years. And then out of the blue, with no explanation, they said, JK, LOL, we're measuring Prevotella species. And they just did the old switcheroo. Yeah. And it's like, oh, so were we telling a whole lot of people that they should be freaked out about rheumatoid arthritis for no reason because you were measuring a genus and not a species? And again, there was no announcement that I'm aware of because I think I got their emails at the time. But, you know, it's and similarly, I guess some of the testing is starting to call it zonulin family proteins now. And it's just like this, oh, whoopsie daisy, JK, LOL kind of moment.
We hope you don't think a little too hard about why this name changed.
Yeah, don't question us too much. We're good, I swear. So just keep that in mind. So there's the, is it an accurate marker? Is it a stable, viable marker? Like, are you going to get different results on different days kind of questioning? But there's also like, are you testing what you think you're testing at all kind of questioning, potentially with zonulin?
Like, is it an accurate reading of what you think you're getting?
Yeah, similar or analogous to if you buy a bottle of echinacea, the first question about that product you should have is, do I really think I'm buying echinacea or is it just like rice flour or fillers or another herb? Like, hopefully they put the actual herb in there that they put on the label. And that's not always the case with commercial products. And this test is no different.
Right. Is it something, now, is it a plant that looked like echinacea that was being confused for echinacea? And it's different.
Well, and I brought that up as an example because there was a problem with that years ago. It might have been 8 or 10 years ago, but as a tangent, I have subscribed to a platform called Consumer Lab for a lot of years, and they do independent third-party testing on a lot of commercially available herbs and supplements and vitamins. And it's just, it's a good resource. Like when people are asking for, you know, like, which brand of berberine to buy, I could tell them one that's like pretty cheap, but also contains what they say it contains. So it's nice for cost savings in particular, as well as like judging the quality of people's existing supplements. Like, do I really need to tell people they have to throw this out and get a new thing? Or is what they have good enough? But they, one of their tests revealed years ago that a few of the products on the market that claimed to have echinacea in them did not. And again, it was just like rice flour or some sort of filler. And there was zero echinacea in at least one or two of the products. So that can happen. But that's a whole topic for another day. We could do a whole episode on supplement quality potentially. I would say another marker that is very intriguing and people talk about a lot is measuring LPS. Now, I don't know if this is something that's available in the functional space, because my understanding is that LPS has a really short half-life and it's really only going to be clinically useful if you are like in a research laboratory at a university where they are, or a hospital, and they're doing the testing on the sample immediately.
Like you're eating and seeing like what happens with the LPS levels and that kind of thing.
They feed you a Whopper and then 30 minutes later they draw the blood. So I think that there's that's literally one type of study they do, by the way. There's the element of you need to harvest the sample at just the right time. Mm-hmm. But also, I think if I remember correctly, that LPS or zonulin or both are not super duper stable. So similarly, you can't hang on to that sample and then wait a week or ship it to a lab in another state, which takes time, and then do the sample. I think you have to really like measure it immediately. But that's another possibility is LPS. It's just not really commercially clinically available to most of us at this point.
Yeah, for sure. And I know they do like LPS antibodies too. I've seen more in the research too than I don't know if that's widely available in the functional space.
Like that one makes some sense to me, and I'm going to keep my eye out for it and see how that progresses. I think that antibodies against LPS clicks because LPS is also called endotoxin, and it's this like inflammatory bad thing that it's a part of the cell wall of gram-negative bacteria. So the immune system sees LPS as a threat, and it sees that as a bad boogeyman that it has to defend you against. Versus, you accidentally segued into one I wanted to bring up. Hmm. Have you seen like the Cyrex leaky gut test where it's antibodies against occludin and zonulin? Have you seen this?
I'm definitely aware of that. I feel like Dr. Karazian's really big on that one.
Karazian's like, trying to a figure huge proponent out, like, of all things Cyrex.
Right. So I remember in a lot of his courses, he would talk through that, you know, paracellular versus transcellular leaky gut, and that those tests can kind of tell. And so I know he talks about that. So I'm aware of that one. I haven't looked into it super in depth.
Yeah, you summarized it well. So I think that the idea is that you can get more specific and you can determine like the flavor of leaky gut for one.
Right. Is it severe? Is it maybe a little more mild?
And is it transcellular versus paracellular? Like that idea. And I'll say, I was a big follower of Karazian. I still like the dude. I think he's pretty smart. But I was a big follower of him. I went to all of his seminars. I basically borderline stalked him in the seminar circuit and watched everything he ever did for years. And that
can I tell you something? Didn't you tell me that you like he caught you hoarding chocolates or something?
Yes. Yeah. So here, we'll tell that briefly. Yes. So it was, I remember it vividly. It was the Mastering Brain Chemistry Seminar in San Diego. And I went there with my best friend, Mamie. And it was one of those hotels that had the Andes mints at all of the tables. And they had little dishes of Andes mints, like the chocolate mint rectangle things.
Yeah. Yep.
So at the end of the seminar, Mamie and I kind of lingered and hung around. And it was only like us and a few other people talking to Karazian. And at the end of the day, we're looking around and we're like, oh my God, there's all of these Andes mints. This is amazing. So being cheap grad students and being chocoholics and just being the goofballs that we are, we went around in this 100 plus person seminar room. We went around and stole all of the chocolates from all of the dishes. And we got like 100 Andes chocolates that day.
Oh my God.
And so we're like putting them in our backpack. So excited. We were happy as pigs and shit. I can't even explain how excited we were. And then it was the next day, the next morning, I guess coincidentally, we started talking about dopamine, and Karazian up on the stage kind of called us out in like a little bit of a passive aggressive way, not going to lie. And he said, yeah, you can spot the dopamine deficient people a mile away because they're chocoholics. And he said something that indicated that he was kind of poking fun at us. And Mamie and I were like, he's judging us.
All right.
Anyhow, I don't think I'm dopamine deficient for the record. I think I just enjoy chocolate.
There's a
difference. But anywho, yeah. So he was and is very keen on all things Cyrex, and he was always promoting their testing and using case studies with those tests in seminars. So I sipped the Kool-Aid a little bit and I thought, oh, this is like the best test for leaky gut. But what's a little bit odd about some of their testing, including this one in particular, is like there's research that Dr. Vijjani has done himself, and he's like a PI on the paper.
Hmm.
But outside of Vijjani's research papers and like Karazian's research papers, I don't really see anybody else talking about antibodies to occludin and zonulin.
Hmm.
And now that I'm thinking about it mechanistically, occludin and zonulin are parts of your own body. So wouldn't that almost be like quasi autoimmunity if you have antibodies to that? Like, that strikes me as really odd to measure antibodies against that. I don't know. Maybe I'm just ill-informed and maybe I haven't taken a deep dive on this particular test as much as I should, but it's striking me as a little bit odd to measure something like that versus, again, like, we know that antibodies against LPS, that means that the immune system is mounting an appropriate attack against something that is seen as a threat, and we like understand that mechanism more. So in more recent years, I have stopped ordering the Cyrex leaky gut test. Well, I've basically stopped ordering leaky gut tests, period, for one. Mm. But if I were going to order a leaky gut test, it wouldn't be this one now, because I think that it's probably needs verification and duplication from other research groups, not just a man who works for the lab and stands to profit from selling this commercial test.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you talk about it being almost like an autoimmune situation. It reminds me of the anti-vinculin antibodies for like the MMC being potentially compromised in SIBO, like how you kind of call it more of an autoimmune SIBO situation if someone has higher anti-vinculin levels. It kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah, me too. And to be clear, I want to throw this out there for the people who are losing their minds right now. I don't know that if you've had a Cyrex leaky gut test and you've had it come back positive, I don't know if it means that there's autoimmunity or if this is like a super bad thing. I'm just spitballing and I'm talking about the physiology and what makes sense to me. And again, I think that there's a difference between measuring antibodies against essentially self tissue and then saying that that's pathologic for leaky gut versus measuring antibodies for a thing that we know the immune system is trained to go after and see as a threat.
Right.
Because when we're looking at antibodies, we're measuring the responsiveness of the immune system against that thing.
Right.
It would make sense that the immune system would be responsive to a pathogen or a fragment from a pathogen. It doesn't super make a lot of sense that the immune system is responsive to self tissue outside of the context of autoimmunity. So that's what I'm getting at. But please don't lose your minds and email us and say, I have autoimmune leaky gut. And we don't know.
Right. Don't come knocking on our doors.
We're going to get all the Instagram DMs, Amy. Oh, God. Brace yourself. Anywho, so that was one that I think was worthy of addressing. I think the last really popular test is, ironically, the OG. We haven't talked about the OG big daddy that's been around for a long time, and that's the lactulose mannitol ratio test, right? And that would be a urine test, like you drink a sugar solution, you collect your pee for, I think it's 6 hours, you mail that off to the lab. Do you have any experience running this one, Amy?
You know, I haven't. You know, I've been aware of it. It seems like a fairly reasonably priced option that has some decent data around it. Like, again, I still don't know if it's a perfect test. But, you know, that would probably be the one that I would maybe more lean to if someone was considering one.
Yeah. Well, I think if we were forced to choose one, I feel like this is probably the lesser of the evils. Now, keep this in mind, lactulose mannitol isn't perfect either. And again, it's still going to run you $250 per test, and you're going to do repeat testing probably. And I still don't think it's worth that for most people. But so there are a couple of potential issues. So like lactulose speeds up gut transit. This is part of the reason why lactulose SIBO testing is an absolute nightmare and it's inaccurate. But we know that lactulose is a laxative and it's a prebiotic. So there's a lot of stuff happening beyond it just being an unabsorbed sugar, which is why we're using it here. And mannitol, oh, dietitian of mine, share some foods that contain mannitol.
Oh, a bunch of foods. I feel like I'm gonna fail on the top of my head at the top of my head, but
that's all right. I'll give you a cheat. Mushrooms.
Yeah, I think, there's so many foods that have mannitol, and I think again, like, that's what always makes me laugh too about like the mycotoxin tests too. Like, there's so many foods with like a little bit of mold on it or a little like fungus on it.
Raspberry, like, it just whatever. Like
skews the results of so many tests. I think they try, don't they try to control for that a little bit? I don't know if they do or not. Do they do like fasting or anything?
I think it's been a few years since I ordered this test because I have ordered this one before through Genova. I think if I remember correctly, they tell you to refrain from high mannitol foods for a couple of days. But now that I'm thinking about it, I'll have to look back. I think I might be getting it confused with the organic acids test that has you eliminate like cranberries.
Like blueberries and there's like
pears. So I might be getting it mixed up, but I think if I remember correctly, they do have you avoid some of the mannitol foods. I don't remember mushrooms on there though. For a period of time, I think you do it fasting, and I don't remember. I think that you do a baseline, like first morning void urine sample first, and then they can compare the amount of the sugars in your urine in the fasting sample versus the 6-hour collection sample. Again, it's been probably at least 3 or 4 years since I was the one to order this for somebody, but. I think they probably try to control for it a bit, but that, again, I think that it's decent. Is it worth the money and the investment for most of the people listening to us? I would say no. But if you held a gun to my head and asked me which one I would order, this would probably be the one.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think it's kind of an OG test. There seems to be a number of studies where they've used it. I agree. This is probably the one I would recommend. But like you said, it's like, I don't really run it. You know, I don't run this test to really have like firsthand knowledge too of like how good it is and that kind of thing. But on paper, this one makes the most sense to me. Now I think like you said, maybe over time, if things become a little bit more easily accessible and not so like clinically or like lab oriented, like where you have to be involved in a study to really understand what's going on. Cause I do think like the LPS scenario makes a lot of sense to me as well, whether you're measuring actual LPS or LPS antibodies. And again, I think logistically that could be difficult as it is right now. I don't think that there's really available options, but that one seems to be maybe slightly more promising. But yeah. I think from what's available to you now, this one makes more sense. But yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to like how much you're investing time, money, that kind of thing to do the test versus just kind of starting to meditate or, you know, walking a little bit, like,
or diversify your diet, getting enough fiber, trying a probiotic,
right? Even like the research time you spend sometimes, like ordering the test, like having to prepare for the test, doing the test. Like, I always thought some of that stuff was stressful too, like during my journey, like doing a breath test when you worked that day or something, like you're having to take a half day. You know, so like it's all these things I think have. We only have so much time, energy, resources to devote to some of this stuff. So again, revisiting the question we had earlier, like, does this really add to anything that you're going to do? Does this change the landscape of what you're planning on doing? If not, again, like, you could consider moving on. Would you feel like there's a scenario where you would probably, where you would order a test? I know we're like,
maybe
we're kind of like, you know, there is these tests kind of like, they're not really that useful. I was trying to think in my head, like what scenario I might,
what
recommend.
Universe would we order it? Yeah. I don't know, because I have a case right now where we talked about leaky gut for a bit this week, actually, but I didn't recommend testing. I recommended treating it empirically. So basically what happened is she was having a lot of digestive distress, couldn't tolerate FODMAPs, couldn't tolerate a lot of protein and meat. Mm. We started with things like supporting stomach acid, getting motility in a better place. We did some Nervines and adaptogens. And we got her to a point where her gut is feeling good. She's pooping, she's digesting well, she could eat all the FODMAPs. She's just back to like gluten and dairy free, which was kind of her baseline diet prior to all of this happening. But she's having some fatigue, brain fog, anxiety kind of stuff. And we talked about it last time and she said it's not like in the past where she's had some anxiety where the mental thoughts lead the way and then the body follows. It's like, it really feels like it's more the body feeling anxious, but her mind doesn't necessarily feel as anxious. So we talked about, okay, well, we've gotten the dysbiosis and the proposed SIBO and the motility stuff and the low stomach. Like we got a lot of that stuff doing much better. And now you're better nourished and we've got a good diet and lots of fiber and variety under our belt. But you still have some lingering inflammatory neurological kind of squirreliness happening. And that's where I said, maybe there's a little bit of remnant leaky gut left over from all the chaos, kind of like the shrapnel after the explosion. Right. And so my recommendation was, let's have you try L-glutamine and see if that makes any changes for you. So I did... I tend to think of leaky gut a little bit later on in the progression of somebody's case where it's like you're feeling better, but there's still some lingering stuff that we can't quite explain. And again, I don't usually recommend testing though, but that's very much in line with how I do it in FODMAP Freedom, where it's, you know, I teach people about nutrition and dysbiosis and the microbes and sleep and adrenals and all of that stuff long before we ever get to the conversation of leaky gut.
Yeah, I think when you peel back so many layers, things become usually more clear. You know, if someone's nutrition is really off, or their stress is crazy, or they're you know, they've restricted so long, so they might have nutrition deficiencies. Like when there's all these elements, and it's like, well, like let's start with the obvious things. Get the fundamentals moving in the right direction. And then even if there's issues, sometimes it's easier to hone in on things. But even in a situation like that too, like it's a interesting to experiment from a leaky gut standpoint of like, oh, let's do a little bit more leaky gut support and see what happens. And again, like hopefully it helps. I think the other thing that I would consider in that scenario too is just like, are there any weird nutrient deficiencies? Sometimes I think that can be a thing that comes up a little later on where it's like, okay, some things are moving in a really good direction, but there's still like some weird mental health stuff going on, or there's still that doesn't make sense, like considering the lifestyle and that kind of thing.
And that's and again, like this lady scenario, like it's not making sense now, and it's yeah, it's not behaving in a way that makes sense to us or that resembles the pattern that she had before. Because before these feelings of brain fog and anxiety were tied to her gut. And it seemed like they kind of came and went in unison with each other. And now they're not as connected, which is very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, you make a good point with nutrients, because there are a lot of different nutrients, vitamins and minerals that are needed to repair the gut lining and keep the microbiome happy and build the mucus layer. So that's a totally valid point. And honestly, before we briefly segue into maybe like a test of sorts that you could do at home, I'll point out, and I tell my students this all the time, again, they don't get the leaky gut part of the class until week 8, and they only get one module a week. So I force them to wait. And I tell them all the time, I say, I do this because I was you. I was in your shoes, and I know damn well that if I had access to all 12 modules all at the get-go, I would skip over module zero through seven, and I would just go for the leaky gut module because I knew that that's what it was. And I was convinced, and nobody was going to tell me otherwise. And I would have skipped over all of the actual treatment for leaky gut. And I would have gotten to that section and been like, oh, I need more glutamine. I force my students to not do that. And I make them go through the process. Theoretically, you could register for my program and you could consume none of the content until week 12, and then you would have access to all 12 modules at once. But nobody does that.
Right.
But, you know, I make them wait because I know that there are so many people who are like, I know Amy and Nikki are telling me to do this, but I want to do leaky gut anyway. It just, I don't know how else to say it. Just listen to us, please, for the love of God, just listen to us.
I feel like we need to have like a segment that just like comes on like in the middle of all our episodes where we like give a hot tip, like hot tip or some like little thing. But this hot tip for today is that you can't cut corners. Like it's like the hottest tip I could give for like IBS and SIBO recovery.
You can't just skip everything else and go right for the leaky gut in the same way that you can't skip everything else and just go for the killing of the starving of the SIBO. Mm-hmm. It will come back. Most of you understand that by now.
Yes. True.
You bunch of silly gooses.
Can I? But, so you had a home test. So I'm
sort of.
I remember a provider that did something for me. I'm curious if it's the same thing. Is it like a GABA?
Test? No. I kind of wonder about the validity of that.
Okay, that was popularized by Karazian. I wonder about the validity of that. Of that too, because that
let's not go into detail though, because people are going to be so tempted to try it. But I know exactly what you're talking about, and that was popularized by Dr. Karazian.
Okay, just forget everything I just said. I'm going to like erase, min and rewind. I'm going to min and black you, or whatever.
I don't know if that's. I don't think that's useful either. But no. So what I was going to say, and this is what I do with FODMAP Freedom students, is I have a quiz built into the program, where I have them self-assess what is the likelihood based off of diagnoses and symptoms that I might have leaky gut. I'm not going to give it all of the different points and stuff because there's quite a few questions to it, but some of it is based off of this paper. I mentioned it in the last episode, but I didn't have the PubMed ID. So here we go, just in case. It's titled Risk Factors Associated with Intestinal Permeability in an Adult Population, A Systematic Review. It's a 2019 paper. The PubMed ID is 312-43854. And basically, this was the paper that we talked about last time that said things like metabolic disease and metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes and obesity are much more strongly linked with leaky gut as opposed to IBS or even something like IBD or celiac disease. So here's one quote from that paper. For example, they said elevated levels of pro-inflammatory markers. So maybe something like C-reactive protein, right? Dyslipidemia. So this would be high triglycerides, high cholesterol kind of stuff. Hyperglycemia, aka high blood sugar. Insulin resistance. So that would be like pre-diabetes or diabetes. Anthropometric, there we go, measurements resembling obesity, advanced disease severity, comorbidity, and the consumption of a Western-style diet, which they usually say is low in fiber, high in simple carbs, and high in unhealthy fats, were identified as the strongest risk factors for altered intestinal integrity. So, little pop quiz here. If you are sitting there and you know that you have type 2 diabetes or even pre-diabetes, if you are obese, if you have high cholesterol or high triglycerides, if you have high C-reactive protein on blood work, if you have eaten a Western-style diet that's devoid of fiber and high in these so-called empty and inflammatory calories, you now know that there's a pretty good likelihood that you have leaky gut. Again, whether or not you want to test for it, it's up to you at this point. I think we made our case strongly enough. But if you have some of those things going on, then I would encourage you to treat leaky gut in conjunction with everything else we've talked about. But again, just don't stop there. don't just take glutamine and cut a bunch of stuff out of your diet and think that that's going to be the cure for this.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. And
I agree, and Missy. Kind of
the other side of the coin from this, to give one more example, in this study and others, they've shown that constipation is really not super linked with leaky gut. Mm. So if you have IBS-C or constipation, don't lose any sleep over leaky gut. Just move on to the next episode and be done with that part of your journey, because there's not a strong likelihood that that's a big factor for you.
Yep. Good point.
So there's your little at-home quiz. Again, it's kind of a hyphenated version of the one that I do in FODMAP Freedom, but that's how I do a lot of stuff in my program, is that I kind of give people these quizzes and these assessments along the way, so that mostly we skirt the need for any sort of actual testing. And yeah, I think that leaky gut, we could do the same thing with. I don't think we need to go spend money on a zonulin test or a GI map or a leaky gut lactulose mannitol test. I think we could probably just use our noodles and go treat the body and treat the gut holistically. And that's all you probably need to do.
Good deal.
Any closing remarks?
No, nothing major.
I think that's about a wrap, people. If I may, so this happened to be perfect timing. If I may be so bold as to put in a 10-second commercial for my own work, speaking of FODMAP Freedom, enrollment opens today, actually, for the people on the waitlist. So if you haven't gone and joined the waitlist for that, go do that. You go to www.fodmapfreedom.com/wait, and you'll hop on the wait list, and then you'll get tomorrow's email with the link and all the info that you need. So you get first dibs on joining. But yes, speak of the devil, I got to mention it in this episode, which I don't always do, but we actually are opening enrollment today.
Ooh, it's exciting.
And it'll be open for about 10 days. So if you're catching this episode later in the week, it should still be open, but come check it out, because we get damn good results and I help you hack through all the bullshit, kind of like I do here, but in a different format. So
love it.
That's my little 10-second commercial. Thank you for indulging me. And we will see you back here for another rip-roaring episode of the IBS Freedom Podcast. Until then, mwah.